observations wherever you may be. We're going to pick up where we left off now, I guess, a couple of weeks ago on observations where we, for I think the third time, read a letter that a man who is known to us as Jerome, his actual name is Eusebius Aronius Sophomoris, we've shortened it to Aronius, wrote to Pope Damascus in 405 CE. This is 5 years after the imposition of Roman Catholicism. Now, at this point, Christianity is the politic and religion of the Empire of Rome. And it is this letter, Kirk, that for anyone who is aware of it, and this letter is easily verifiable, Google it, you know, Jerome's letter to Pope Damascus. Read it for yourself. If you are informed, in other words, you've read the letter, and you're also aware of the status of the Greek text that he will cite as being the solution, particularly recognizing that Greek was not the original language. Yosha spoke Hebrew. The disciples spoke Hebrew. Their Hebrew words were translated into Greek. So Greek was a translation, not the original language. And that the Greek scribes were worse than the Roman Latin scribes in terms of propensity to change the text to suit their sponsor's agenda. There's always a religious sponsor. So with the added knowledge of those two things and a rational mind, 100% of those who hear what we are going to say now will throw away the Christian Bible and discard the religion if they have previously identified themselves with it. Because this proves in no uncertain terms that the text of the Christian New Testament cannot and should not be trusted and cannot be fixed.
Yeah.
So we'll read that and then we'll move beyond it, continuing to cite the implications of it as we continue to do this program. This is Eusebius Aronius Sophomoris, Jerome, writing to the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church within 5 years of the time that it was imposed on the Roman Empire. If we are to pin our faith to the Latin text, it is for our opponents to tell us which. For there are almost as many forms of text as there are copies. If, on the other hand, we are to glean the truth from a comparison of many, why not go back to the original Greek and correct the mistakes introduced by inaccurate translators and blundering alterations of confident but ignorant critics, and further, all that has been inserted or changed by copyists more asleep than awake. That's every time I read that, just every single word of it, Kirk, screams out to me and says, how in the world? Recognizing that within 5 years of the birth of the Christian Church, and this is when it was imposed. It was Theodosius. It was not Constantine that was the individual that converted the Roman Empire to Christianity. Constantine didn't even convert to Christianity himself. He remained a devotee to Mithras, the unconquerable sun, his entire life. He was buried in the garb of Mithraism.
Mm-hmm.
His coinage always showed that he was a devotee of Mithras. This idea that he legalized Christianity, what he actually did, if you read his edict, the Edict of Milan, what he did is He said that every religion in the Roman Empire, with the exception of anything that had association with Yahud, Jews, was legal, as they all pray to the same God. That is true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Lord of Christianity is the same Lord of the Canaanites, was the Lord of the Egyptians, was the Lord of the Babylonians, was the Lord of the Assyrians, Satan. And so he was right, but he didn't establish Christianity as the religion of Rome. He just put all religions on the same footing, excluding everything that had to do with the Yahud, the Jews, which was continued to be illegal. And so it was Theodosius who in 405 from Constantinople that established, actually imposed Christianity. He became the first emperor pope, if you will.
Yeah.
And he's also the person who doomed Europe to 1,000 years of hell. He imposed the feudal system of lords and serfs.
Mm-hmm.
That was Theodosius. Theodosius is going to be in the top 10 amongst those most despised individuals by Yahweh. Oh, boy, Kirk. I have been translating Yeshaya Isaiah 9. And, of course, the sixth verse of Isaiah 9 and parts of the seventh are the single most quoted by Christians worldwide. You know, it begins by saying, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given.
Right.
Well, the context of that and what it says thereafter, what it said before and what it says thereafter, is one of the most enlightening, riveting, chilling things I've ever translated.
How so?
Well, first of all, 100% of the context surrounding that, the most famous of quotes,
mm-hmm.
has nothing to do with a Jesus, or even, if you will, Yosha. He's not named, and he's not the subject. Do you know who the subject is?
No.
The one person who's named in the prophecy? The one person that's named in the prophecy.
Maybe Paul.
No. Well, Paul is gets referred to later by the reference lowly and little one.
Because
Paulos means lowly and little. It does come up later in the prophetic account. No, the one person who is mentioned by name in the midst of the most commonly translated or most commonly proclaimed prophetic announcement in Christianity, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The one person who's named is Dode.
Oh, okay.
Dode is named. And Yahweh says that his kingdom and his seat of honor are not just going to be reestablished, but they're going to endure forever.
Adalom, probably.
Yeah, forever. Adalom, for all time.
How does a Christian deal with that?
Well, and you know what? The other thing that's so interesting is the preamble to it is a vicious, unmitigated attack on religion and politics. And it's set into the time when Yahweh was on the cusp of disassociating himself for the long time out in parenting. We'd call it a timeout. Well, this was a timeout of about anywhere from 25 to 2700 years, depending on if you are on the 10 tribes or two tribes, if you're a northern kingdom or the province of the kingdom of Yahuda, the southern kingdom. And so the timing of this deals with conditions that justified Yahweh's long timeout. You know, you give a child a timeout if that child is unwilling to learn, if there's no other way to encourage them to think about what they have done and improve their behavior. It's a timeout. And, well, Yahweh's timeout with 10 of the 12 tribes is 2,700 years.
Mm-hmm.
With his timeout with the tribe of Yahuda, it's 2,500 years. And so that's when this is being proclaimed. And the context is, it even mentions the king of Assyria by name. And how Yahweh is going to just allow them to run roughshod over Israel because of their religious behavior, and how he finds their religion so reprehensible. And that's what leads into it, and what comes out of it is the most adroit, most unmitigating attack on religion and politics that I've ever read. And Yahweh flat out says, I'm not going to save them. I'm not going to show any mercy or compassion to them. I'm not going to pity them. It's over for them. There's no salvation. He goes, these are religious and political people, no mistaking it. He says there'll be no salvation for them. There'll be no pity for them. There'll be no compassion for them, no mercy for them. It is, in your face, in direct opposition to religion. And so this is just one of so many examples of what happens if you take a statement out of context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Christians think, well, this is the great announcement of Jesus. Well, the fact of the matter is, the context of it is in one of two different settings, neither of which apply to what occurred in year 4000 Yah, 2 BCE, in terms of the arrival of the child,
right?
And nor 4000 Yah in 33 CE. They don't apply to that period of time. It applies to Israel circa 700 BCE and his return. You know, moreover, Yahusha was never called the Eternal Father.
No.
No, never once. In fact, he was pointed to the Father.
Mm-hmm.
He was never called Almighty God. Never, never. What did he refer to himself as?
He just as a man.
The Son of Man.
Son of Man.
Yeah. Which, by the way, indicates what is now absolutely apparent to me. He was not virgin born. You know, prophecy doesn't say so. Matanyahu was either Matanyahu or a copyist who added to it.
Or in the Torah to claim, where you can claim it there either.
Yeah, it's...
Doesn't that make even more bullet holes in Matthew? I mean, I'm getting aware the New Testament means absolutely nothing other than a comparative study.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's no way to know if Matthew made the mistake or if later copyist did what Jerome is claiming here. You know, an ignorant person who made alterations and changes. I don't know which one, but I do know that for the religion of Christianity, virgin birth was essential because in every pagan religion, the son of the son was virgin born.
Yeah,
in every pagan religion, the mother of God and the queen of heaven was also the virgin and child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the case in Babylon. That was the case in Assyria. It was the case with the Canaanites. It was the case with the Egyptians. It was the case in every pagan religion. And so the new God of Christianity couldn't be inferior to the pagan gods. So it was... just stole from pagan theology and caused him to be virgin born. It actually makes Yahusha and Yahweh's solution vastly more impressive. He was born as an ordinary man. He lived as an ordinary individual all the way up to 30 when the set apart spirit descended upon him. And Yahweh at that point at 30 declared him, "This is my son of whom I'm proud." And for the next 3 years, He had the soul of Yahweh and the spirit of the set-apart spirit upon him, and he was the diminished manifestation of Yahweh on earth for the next 3.5 years, and then he relinquished that which made him the diminished manifestation of Yahweh on earth, the set-apart spirit, towards the end of Passover, so that his physical body could die as the Passover lamb, because God himself could not die. Anyway, the amount of information and the absolute unequivocal nature of the prediction that Yahweh has in Yeshaya 9, describing what he is going to do to the world's religious and political leaders, is just more unequivocal, more blunt, more all-encompassing than anything we've encountered thus far. And it's so much so that for any Christian to be carrying around a Bible and still trust, believe, place their faith in their religious leaders, you are a nincompoop.
Let me ask you, when you're translating this, are you finding any difficulty in as far as, let me put it another way. Last night I did 19:7. Because that was a key to me on some things I was studying about Christian apologists. And if that's true, then, of course, nothing. It's a moot point what they say. But regardless, it's so obvious that that's exactly – I mean, I'm not patting – I'll pat you on the back anyway, but I'm not patting on you, doing this to pat you on the back, that your translations are so accurate. I went through everything I've got to my available. And it's a very short thing, but every one of those come to the same thing that you said. And I did it kind of independently. I know I've read it before, but I did it independently. And it's exactly the same translation I would have made that you made. I may have been a little more wordy, but...
If you're going to be more wordy than I am, more verbose than I am, that's an accomplishment.
I would have picked out a few more words, like when it says, you know, Yah's Torah is perfect or complete, and I'm probably going to use a few more adjectives, you know, things like that, because just to make for clarity for it. But I'm going through this over and over and over, and then I went through my 26 translations of the of all the Bibles, and it's even obvious the way they translate it, that this is true, other than the twist they put on, like the Torah just becomes law when Yahweh becomes Lord. But when you look it up, any darn fool could look it up, and you're not going to find it anywhere where it's contradicting what you translated.
Now, I'm going to tell you that as I strive to translate Yeshaya, that it is a challenge for me. It's by far the hardest prophet for me to translate, because his vocabulary is much more extensive than anyone else. So words that I've dealt with 10,000 times, they appear, but in so many of the other books, the majority of the text is comprised using the same vocabulary. In Yeshaya, if there are 10 words for to say the same thing in English, he'll use all 10 of them. And if he uses 10 words to say what we would translate as one word, then we darn well better take the time to understand what the nuances are that cause one to be slightly different than the other. And so, it takes a lot more time, but it's also a lot more rewarding. Let's just take a moment. We'll go to Yeshaya chapter 9. This is what I find so amazing, is the preamble to it speaks of a telescope's time. It telescopes time from 2,700 years ago to 16 years from now. It begins, "Nevertheless, there will be no sadness nor gloomy darkness for those who were subjugated and oppressed. This for her is in contrast to the previous time when he receded from the land of Zebulun and the land of the Naphtali.
Mm-hmm.
No, telescoping time. Yosha, those are two tribes in the Northern Kingdom. They happen to be the far north of the land.
One of the center, yeah, goes all the way to the center. The one of them hits that part of the coast.
Yeah, the thoroughfare
all the way down.
Mm-hmm. And interesting references to both of those two. In fact, in the chapter, I tracked down everything that I could learn about both of those two tribes, and it was really an interesting study. But now there's going to be a time of no sadness for those who were subjugated and oppressed. Well, that has not occurred yet. So in the first part of 9-1, we're dealing with the future, with what's going to happen here in 2033 in our Roman Catholic pagan calendars, year 6000, yeah. Then in a later time, following that, he will severely and harshly deal with the stubborn and irrational, the pretentious and oppressive nature of the way of the sea. On the opposing side of the Yarden, concerning the socio-political realm of the Gentile nations. Now, a short time after that, you know how long after that? Because he specifies it later in Yeshaya. So, going to end all the gloomy darkness for those who are subjugated and oppressed. And then after that, he's going to severely and harshly deal with the socio-political realm of the Gentile nations.
Well, it has to be 5 days. Yom Kippurim to...
One.
Oh, one day. Okay. Well,
One day.
Four more days you can clean up.
He states, I'm going to do all this in one day.
Okay. Good deal.
That's if you can get by the stalks of palms and reeds and tails.
Okay.
Later on, you'll see that that you really have to look at what the words convey, so that you can see who and what he is eliminating in that one day. But in one of the first of the 5 days, all these people are gone. The family of related individuals who have walked in darkness and error will see an appearance of a great and expansive light. For those who have lived in the realm of foreboding darkness and the shadow of death, a light will shine on them. Has this occurred?
No.
What is he talking about?
He's talking about Yahweh returning.
Yeah, absolutely. Yahweh's return is going to appear brighter than the sun, like a whole galaxy, if you will, of stars.
Now, that proves your point that he's going to destroy them, and it wasn't the light that necessarily melted them like you had talked about years ago.
Yeah.
So that gets you a little separation there on, I'm going to wipe these out, then I'm appearing.
He is going to wipe out the opposing militaries with his light.
Okay.
They will be incinerated. But the leadership is going to be cut down and separated. You have improved and prolonged the lives. This is Yeshaya speaking to Yahweh. You have improved and prolonged the lives of a number of those from different places and races. Goy, increasing and nurturing their joy. Cheerfully, they will rejoice in your presence and before your appearance, similar to the jubilation of the ingathering during the harvest, just as they will be ecstatic when they share in the spoil, the apportioning of property and possessions they have gained. This is the covenant. Covenant members who were harvested on Teruah, probably 6 or 7 years prior to his return. And we're going to be there. In fact, there are portions of Matanya which I think are reasonably accurate. This is described in the Olivet Discourse.
Yeah.
For indeed, you have cast away the yoke of his economic burden from his back, along with the means to extend the reach and influence of the ruling authorities, ruling the staff, that'd be religious people, a scepter, political people, or spear, the military.
Right.
With regard to those who would strive to exploit him, exerting their influence over him. So similar to the day of Midian, the den, surely Since every boot worn by the trampling soldiers of marching armies is part of the commotion and clamor of battle, the staccato percussion of weapons, and the fearful response to it all, along with the clothing which is befouled by wallowing in blood, they will come to exist as fuel to be burned up in the fire of blazing light.
Oh.
Here, we will speak probably a number of shows about the Day of Midian and who the participants were and what we can learn from that story. But what this says is that upon his return, there will be massive armies in Israel. They will have gathered to destroy Yahweh's favorite place and people, and they will be obliterated. If you are in the military at this time, this is your fate. Now, that is the last statement prior to the most quoted line in Christendom. And what period of time is he talking about?
Current. I mean, a future.
Slight future. Right. For indeed, a child, a young boy, from infant to young man, is born, is conceived and brought forth through a pregnant woman. He is an ordinary child. So for indeed, a child is born to us. A son, a male descendant, is given to us. Now, what the interesting thing is, there's only one person who is named in this account, Dode.
Mm-hmm.
Dode was a child who was born. And if ever there was a human being that was considered the Son of God, declared the Son of God, it's Dode.
This is wild.
Yeah, and he was certainly given to us.
Yeah, he was a gift.
Yeah, he was. He was a gift. Now, I'm not saying that it doesn't also apply to Yosha. Almost everything that applies to Dode applies to Yosha. Almost everything that applies to Yosha applies to Dode. That's why both men are constantly referred to as the branch. The most commonly used title to describe Yosha in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is also the most commonly used title to describe Dode. And both men are the only individuals that Yahweh specifically says, he is my son, I am his father. In fact, Dode is the only person whom it is said both, he is my son, I am his father. Dode.
Wow.
I think Dode is the greatest gift to man. Not more than appreciative of what Yahweh did through Yosha on Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah. But I wouldn't know diddly squat about them or how to capitalize upon this gift if it weren't for Dode. The means to engage and endure, this is Misra, the means to empowerment and liberation, the ability to persist and persevere, from Sarah. Ever heard that name before?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Misra is Sarah, the middle name of Israel, and it is also the name of the mother of the covenant, Sarah. It means to persist, persevere, and endure, to engage and contend, exerting oneself powerfully, to be let loose and set free, and to be empowered. So the means to all of those things, to engage and endure, shall exist upon his shoulder. Now, that would be true to some extent of Yosha and to a full extent of Dode. He's the person who made all of that known to us. Now, his expose is on Yahweh and the covenant and the Torah. He's the person who made what it's like to engage and endure with God, to be liberated by Yahweh, known to us.
Yeah.
Then it says, now, what follows cannot be applied to either individual. Okay? What follows cannot be applied to either Dode or Yosha. And so, at this point, Yahweh is telescoping time and telescoping his overall nature and intent to say that, you know, the reason for that, and this is actually, Yeshayah speaking.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, you know, because of all of that, let me tell you about the person I'm speaking to. He's now speaking to Yahweh. Then his name shall be called out. Now, his name has never been called out, Wonderful Counselor. Not Yahweh.
No.
His name. You know, they want to call out Yosha's name, whether Jesus is Wonderful Counselor.
Wonderful Counselor,
no,
right.
He wasn't the counselor. The set-apart spirit is the counselor, is the advisor.
Yeah, he had a different job.
Right. That's the job of the set-apart spirit.
Set-apart spirit, of course.
Right. So his name shall be called out, Wonderful Counselor. That's not dealing with Yosha. Now, is it dealing with Dod? Well, let's look at Counselor.
Well,
Counselor is advisor and consultant, one who provides directions and thought-provoking guidance to deliberate, one who proposes and reveals the purpose and the plan. That's Dod more than anyone in all of human. That's Dod more than anyone in human history.
Yeah.
And wonderful Pele was marvelous and amazing, extraordinary and distinguished, set apart and separating.
No.
So at this point, that could be Dod.
Yeah.
But the next line is not Dod.
Okay.
In a way. But in a way, it is. Now, what do I mean? Next line is Almighty God, powerful, prevailing, confirming, and strengthening. Now, this, Gabor means powerful, prevailing, confirming, and strengthening. And it's possessive of God. So it could be the powerful and prevailing, confirming, and strengthening of God.
Well, it certainly is the streaming of God when you talk about Dod.
Yes. He is. He is God's representative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly with Yosha, he would never once refer to himself as Almighty God.
No, that would be...
Father is greater than I.
You've got to point back to God, to Yahweh.
Yes.
And he did all the time.
Right. But he could be the powerful and prevailing, confirming and strengthening of God. Dod could be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then it says, Eternal Father. Dod was the father of a number of sons, but one of his sons in particular is renowned, Solomon.
Mm-hmm. Solomon.
And Dod is also the father, really, of the nation of Yisrael. Mm-hmm. There's the people of Yisrael, but there was no nation of Yisrael until Dod.
Yeah. That's true. And, of course, he's Yosha's descended from his line, too. So
right. And so in the father-son relationship between Dod and Yahweh, there's also a father-son relationship between Dod and Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And Dod's place of honor is forever, folks. So then it goes on to say, the means to empower reconciliation. This is Lasard. Everyone wants to translate it government, and I have no idea why they want to translate it government, or they want to translate it as prince. But it's the one who acts and delivers, who has the authority and power to prevail with regard to reconciliation, shalom, peace, prosperity, satisfaction, and favor, friendship and companionship. So the other place, I guess it's. The Misra is the one they want to translate as government, even though there's nothing associated with government. In fact, it's the antithesis of government. It's the means to empowerment and liberation. Government is the antithesis of that.
That's free.
Right.
Not the other way around.
Right. So it is not government shall reside on his shoulder, and he's not the prince of peace. Sar means the one who acts and delivers, who is the authority and power to prevail. Of reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was fascinating. And I go into the pages of diagnostics on talking about each of these words. Then it goes to the next statement. And it's not a next statement. It's actually a continuation of what we just read. So I see in your mind an ellipsis. Tremendously, Rob. abundantly, greatly, and extensively. Increasing, this is Islam, growing and intensifying. The power to engage and endure. This is Ha Misra again. Tremendously increasing the means to liberation, the means to persist, the ability to persevere, to engage, and to endure.
Endure, yeah.
So that reconciliation, prosperity, and complete satisfaction, shalom, will exist without end upon the throne of Dode. Oh, what was that name?
Dode.
Wait a minute. We're in the same sentence.
Yeah.
And all of this exists tremendously increasing the power to engage and endure so that reconciliation, prosperity, and complete satisfaction will continue to exist without end, will never cease upon the seat of honor of Dode. They don't want to go there. Why? Because Dode proves that Paul lied. Paul proves, or Dode proves, that Christianity is a hoax. He violated every part of the Torah. But because he was right regarding the Torah, yeah.
Come on.
It's not about being good, it's about being right. That's what Dode proved.
So
all of this is tremendously increased the power to engage and endure so that reconciliation, prosperity, and complete satisfaction are without end, never ceasing, upon the throne of Dode. And with his kingdom sustained and supported, with the means to exercise good judgment and to resolve disputes, and with righteousness, being correct, being acquitted, being vindicated, from this time and forevermore. The deep devotion and tremendous passion of Yahweh, of the spiritual implements, will make this happen. He's talking about Dode.
Mm-hmm.
The most important person who ever lived. The most brilliant person who ever lived. The most revealing and enlightening person who ever lived. That was the Yeshayah 9:7. That was the passage you worked on.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that passage alone wipes everybody out. I mean, you cannot. If I was a theologian, and I'm taking a little bit of a side here, but it's the same context, I think. If I was a theologian or I was a lexicon writer, a researcher, and I put all these words together out of the 9.7, and I didn't disturb me, and I could sleep that night, I would be, and still call myself a Christian, I would have to be brain dead.
You have to be brain dead, yeah.
Brain dead.
You get through about the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th verse of Yeshayah 9.
Yeah.
And you come unglued that 3 billion people today lug around a book that contains this prophecy of Yeshayah 9, and they believe they're religious leaders. When God says, now, if you do it, you'll be as corrupt as they are. If you do it, you're going to have consumed their poison. And he specifically calls out religious and political leaders throughout the rest of Yeshayah to absolutely, just emphatically expose and condemn them. That's what follows. And, immediately thereafter, Yahweh returns to Yisrael circa 2,700 years ago, 700 BCE. And, he says, Yahweh has sent out with the Jacob, a word with Jacob, and it will be allocated to Yisrael. And then he says, all the people were evil. Even Ephraim and the inhabitants of Shimron, which is the to be observant from Shamar. It's the area north and east of Yehuda. Samaria is what it's been translated or rendered as. Who say, in the pride of their conceit and in the arrogance of their hearts, conveying their perceptions of themselves, the sun-dried bricks and clay writing tablets have fallen, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been cut down, but we will change them to cedars. In other words, God's saying, replacement theology. Okay, so we'll just replace what God said. So, you know, you're going to use the fig tree to describe Israel? Yeah, we'll go with cedars. How about that? We've had our whitewashed clay tablets. That's where we read that whole story of the history of the Bible, if you will, of the Canaanite religion.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we have all of that. But okay, so you've shattered them. We'll just come up with much more polished versions of them. Yeah, this replacement theology. That's the arrogance of it all. That's why God is so angry at them. And they did it by saying, okay, so we threw away the Torah, but we replaced it with the Talmud. So we're dealing now again with 2,700 BCE, or 700 BCE, 2,700 years ago. Therefore, this is, you know, this passage that Christians take out of context, particularly at this time of year. Therefore, Yahweh will allow the adversaries of Retzin. Retzin means the self-serving and pleasure-seeking one. He was the king of Aram, of what we now call Syria. The Aramenians were the names of these people that had a fairly short existence. Well, actually several hundred years, but... they're just now becoming known to us from archaeology. Therefore, Yah will allow the adversaries of Retzin to do as they intend against him. So his enemies will be spurred on, Aram, the Syrians, from the east, and the Philistine from the west. They will devour Yisrael with open mouths.
Mm-hmm.
And for all of this, his frustration has not returned. And his hands are still outstretched. I said, you know, if you just cut it with all of that religious mumbo jumbo, all this militarization, and all of this politic, if you just cut it out. Read the Torah, respond to me. I'm right here with open arms.
You know, I was trying to figure out how to get away with this.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the arguments of the three that I found in so many of these books and in a category is on the documents. And here's what they did as opposed to what you do and James does and I do and a whole host of people out there as well, where we go to the Hebrew writings and the Torah and the Masoretic and the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually translate the Hebrew. Here's what they present you with briefly. They agree that the oldest documents and manuscripts are important because they have less errors.
Right.
However, the oldest documents that they're talking about are concerned with are the ones of in Greek. No, this is the way it's presented. I mean, 50, 60 pages of this. They concern was they presented with the letters of Paul's and the Acts. Luke's Gospels, overwhelmingly, over the others. These groups of theologians, and there's a lot of them from many, many years, even several centuries, included in these books I was reading, they discussed they validated pretty much with the Septuagint, even though you've done hours on the Septuagint only, you know, you can't even find the original one and the others are...
there's only one fragment of about five sentences that exists from about 175 BCE of a slight segment of Devarim from the Torah, five or six sentences. That's it. Until you reach the first even remotely complete copy of the Septuagint, dates to 500 CE.
So you've got almost a 600-year gap there, 500 and a half.
Oh, if you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, like the Great Isaiah Scroll is 200 BCE.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're talking about 700 years older.
Yeah, but see, they don't want you to read that or even entertain that thought. They want you to understand it, and they discuss it. They say the reason the Septuagint and all that they do have are ratified, as far as they're concerned, then is because they're in the Greek language. And then they go on to say that the New Testament...
They hate Hebrew.
Yeah. But right. The underpinning thing, but they don't come right out and say
that.
Yeah,
you know, what happens is the Roman Catholic Church hates both Hebrew and Greek. Now, they despise Hebrew to the point that when they were empowered, anybody caught with a Hebrew text was burned alive in it. And that's why we don't have a Hebrew copy of Matanyah. As it relates to the Greeks, they hated Latin. And so Protestant Christians hate the Latin of the Roman Catholic Church, and they're all into their Greek, and their pastors will cite Greek and explain the Greek in their churches. But
let me give you a quote from one of the theologians, and this is just bizarre. He said it's Richard Roth, who's early 1900s. He says that it is the new language of the Holy Ghost, invented for the purpose of expressing divine truth. And I found three other guys who...
You know, but just talk about how just unbelievably stupid that is. And by the way, when we get further in Yeshaya 9, he's just going to say, these people are irreconcilably stupid.
Yeah, well, there's no...
He just says, there's no hope for them. They're stupid. I can't fix stupid. And I'm not going to even try to fix stupid. And I don't want you to have any compassion or any pity or any concern for the stupid. They chose it. That person who said that it was the language written for the Holy Ghost, mind you, there is no Holy Ghost as a set apart spirit.
Invented for the Holy Ghost.
Yeah, invented for it.
Invented for the purpose of expressing
the Greek language was invented for the purpose of conveying the Greek philosophy of politics and religion. The Greek language is inseparable from the pagan Greek religion. The Greek religion, in fact, the individual, he's a mythological individual, but Dionysus is the closest character of pagan mythology to the Christian Jesus. Mm-hmm. Almost everything about Dionysus is manifest in the Christian perception of Jesus. And Paul himself quotes Dionysus, the name that they gave Yosha even ends in Zeus, Jesus.
Yes.
Zeus was, of course, the head god of the Greeks. The Greek language was invented as a means to convey Greek religious and political thought. And you talk about the Greek philosophers and the Greek scholars and the like, all of them, Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, all of them were pagans. They were absolutely wrong as it relates to anything to do with God, and they were wrong as Gnostics in terms of their pursuit of what is real and what is not, what is good and what is bad. And so, the language of Greek, the reason that trying to translate the Christian New Testament, beyond the fact that the text is wholly unreliable, one of the problems in translating, I just finally gave up, not only because the text itself is so unreliable, but because the language is so inappropriate.
Well, the there could be multiple words, and you'd have to use them all, and then you break them all down. You can't. It's hard. I tried to do Matthew's some Matthew stuff, and it just took me forever.
Well, it's
of course, I'm slow anyway.
I think it's actually an easier language to translate because there's so many more tools available, although the tenses are extreme. There's so many more tenses in Greek than there are in English. And so to correctly convey all of that is a bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that the language is difficult to translate. It's that the language is so extreme in its differentiation from Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't. It doesn't translate well. Yeah, it does not translate well.
It is what it is in Hebrew. You know, more times than not, this is it. This is what this means. You know, it's very concrete. It's in terms that we can all understand without getting all the woo.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that's interesting too is that, for example, Greek has a word pistis, which is rendered faith today. Didn't mean faith. It originally meant to trust and rely. That was what the word meant. But in that it is ubiquitous in Paul's writing with the religion of Christianity. It's now rendered faith because, of course, Paul never gave you enough information to trust and rely on anything. Therefore, it was only faith that would prevail. And he uses pistis to mean faith. There is no word even remotely akin to faith in Hebrew.
No. Isn't that interesting?
Now, there is a word in Hebrew, and Paul uses it, telling people they have to obey what he wrote, and he tells people they have to submit to the ruling authorities of every country, even in this letter to the Romans, which were the most vicious, ungodly people on earth. There's no word for obey in Hebrew. You know, that the languages are as different from one another as they could possibly be. I mean, you look at Hades, and in Greek, it's the name of a Greek god, the god of death and destruction, Hades. That's hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Hebrew, the similar place is called Sheol, and it's named after Shaul, the author of the Christian New Testament. So it's filled with errors. And one of the biggest problems is, of course, they in the Greek alphabet is incapable of transliterating, replicating the sound of Yahweh or Yosha. They don't have the letters in the Greek alphabet cannot correctly replicate that sound. And so you don't find Yahweh or Yosha written out a single place, even in the oldest 69 manuscripts of the so-called Christian New Testament. It can't be
written.
Well,
that would mean that the Ruach Kodesh wouldn't have chosen.
Well, we're going
to get this, and they just told you he did or she did.
Yeah, no, it's obvious. It's obvious that it was not a language
chosen by Yahweh to express his witness. No.
You know, it's interesting that when Yahweh is speaking of what's going to occur in our future,
yes, sir.
He's conveying in Hebrew.
Yes.
When anyone visits heaven and listens to what's being said, it's always being said in Hebrew. Every word that Yosha spoke was Hebrew.
Right.
Hebrew is God's language. If you don't like it because you've been convinced that all things Hebrew are bad, then too bad for you. Go away. You will never know God. You will never see heaven. Good riddance. Goodbye. Hebrew is his language. It has always been. It will always be. He spoke Hebrew to Adam and to everyone he ever engaged with at all time.
Yep.
So as we, and I want to, we're going to return to Yeshayah 9, because it's really just starting to get interesting. But let's return to the ninth chapter of Observations.
Okay.
What I wrote, and I'm going to read some of what I wrote because I work to
where you are.
Yeah, I'm on page 31 of it for those who are following along in the text. And what I want people to know is that once they heard, as we've just reread Jerome's letter to Pope Damascus, once you have heard that, once you have read that, it should be over for Christianity.
You have to make a choice.
Yeah, seeking credibility for his religion, Jerome destroyed it. If you are awake, if your mind is open, if you are rational, upon reading this, you should reject Christianity and the New Testament if you haven't already. The very foundation of the religion is fraudulent, predicated on a deliberate babble. 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 Mixing together of inconsistent and conflicting hearsay testimony. There is no question as to why the book that Christians lug around is called a Bible. Bible and Babel are written identically in Hebrew.
Amazing.
It's a mixing together. Apart from the Greek Orthodox Church and the Copts in Egypt, the Vulgate served as the foundation of Christianity for over 1,000 years. And now we know that the text was a deliberate amalgamation of errors, the product of acknowledged ignorance, the result of accepting blunders. Those who promoted it cannot and should not be trusted. If you believe what they concocted out of incongruous material, if your faith is based upon the message they manipulated, you are an idiot. And God sees you as a fool. The variances between the late 4th and early 5th century Greek manuscripts of the Christian New Testament are overwhelming. Something Jerome, Eusebius, Sophronius, should have known as a Greek scholar. In fact, did know as a Greek scholar. But deliberately omitted from his letter to Pope Damascus. A score of unreliable letters, a score of unreliable texts, inconsistent and incompatible Greek texts, cannot be used as a means to fix the problem of discordant Latin texts. One does not derive truth by distilling a vast array of errors into a single amalgamation of those many mistakes. This obliterates the myth held by Christians that their God would never allow his word to be corrupted. Sorry. Facts are facts. Putting Paul's disagreements with Theosia aside for a moment, there has never been a time when the foundational texts of the Christian New Testament agreed with one another. As a result, God either allowed the Christian New Testament to be corrupted because he had nothing to do with it in the first place, or he was impotent and thus unable to stop the unfathomable number of alterations. And in this case, only the initial option is viable, because faith in any God incapable of providing mankind with credible testimony is a fool's folly. Faith is therefore required because knowledge resulting from in trust is impossible.
Well said.
Since these points are logically irrefutable, there was absolutely no chance whatsoever that Eusebius, Jerome, could have somehow resolved the inaccuracies and blunders found in the early Latin texts of the Christian New Testament by referring to Greek manuscripts, especially since he errantly claimed in his letter to his Pope that Greek represented the original language. Truth cannot be derived from a false premise. Greek was not the original language. Yahusha spoke Hebrew, never Greek.